I want to welcome you all. I'm glad you're all here. And the title of this workshop is called Nature Surprises. But when I was first asked to do this, and this is my first, about a year and a half ago, they sent me a little blurb that gave a little bit of a description of what I'm supposed to talk about here. And it said, a shallow look at nature yields a few surprises. But when we dig in and spend some extra time with nature, we find out that God's creation is bubbling with unexpected wonders that will show us the glory of the Creator. And that's what we want to focus on when we look at the natural world, is the glory of the Creator. And even more than just these nature surprises, and we're going to look at a number of those too, I'd like to go beyond that. And looking at the Creator, when we look at the natural world that God has created, we want to look at it and focus on the reflection in the natural world of the Creator Himself. Now, I'll give you a little illustration of this. Say you have a couple of men that are going to, and they're furniture makers. Two men are going to make a couple of dressers with drawers. Okay, they're both craftsmen. The first man, what he does is select the wood he's going to use in the furniture that he makes. Then he looks around and he finds alder. Alder's a good wood to make furniture out of. There's nothing wrong with that. The second man, he looks a little further and he finds black walnut. He says, black walnut is an excellent wood to make furniture out of. Next step they go to is when they make the drawers in these dressers these men are making, one man glues the ends of the face pieces and the back piece and the sides and glues them with a hardwood glue, and that's fine, that works good. But the other man, he dovetails all the junctions. That's just a little extra. Then when they go to make the slides for the drawers, one man, he uses plastic slides, and plastic on plastic slides real good. You make it square and it'll fit fine. It'll open and close fine. But the other man, he wants to go a little further. And he's going to make it with steel rails that have ball bearing rollers in them. So that makes it just a little more perfect. And on it goes. When these products are finished, they're both good products. But the finished product tells you something about the craftsman. It just gives you an indication of the craftsman. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with either one of them, but it still tells you something about the craftsman. And if any of you are hobbyists or craftsmen of any kind, what you make is a reflection of you in some sense. The natural world itself reflects the nature, the character of the Creator Himself. And that's what we want to see when we look into the natural world. And as we get into the details here, hopefully it'll broaden out a little so you know what I'm talking about here. In Sisters, Oregon, there's a man I know named Ed Beecham, and Ed Beecham owns the clock shop over there. Ed is a world master clockmaker. And if you've ever been over there, if you've ever seen any of his work, it is absolutely beautiful. But there's something a little bit different about Ed as a clockmaker. He makes all the parts that go into his clocks. He makes the gears. He makes the springs, he makes the pendulum, he makes the face of the clock, he even makes the cabinets, he even cuts the glass. And he does beautiful workmanship. That's a reflection, to a certain point, on this man. Ed Beecham is also a Christian man. He's also a Christian minister. And in the conversations I've had with him, he is a very godly man. We have an awful lot in common. When we look at the natural world and the universe, we want to focus on just four things this morning, and there's a lot more that we could focus on. And we want to focus on the beauty of the natural world as a reflection of the beauty of its Creator. We want to look at the order of the natural world as a sense of order in the Creator Himself. We want to look at the design, the infinite detail, the intricacy that goes into the design of everything He's made. And that's everything from the mosquito to the blue whale. It's a almost overwhelming infinity of specific design that goes into everything that He's made. And when we look at these things in creation, we want to see that in the Creator Himself. And also in variety. We want to look at variety in the natural world. And just as a brief introduction there, in mammals, the mammals of the earth, and the mammal is a cold-blooded, fur-bearing, live-bearing animal. Separates it from the birds and the fish and other things. Mammals alone, there's over 5,000 different specific different species on this earth. 5,000. Each one of them is intricately designed. Beauty, when you think back again on the beauty of what God has created, there's a verse in Scripture in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. It says, "He hath made everything beautiful in his time." And we may think, when we think of, oh, the hummingbird or, different wildlife. Sometimes you think of things like the tarantula, the rattlesnake, the bat. They're not beautiful. But we're not looking at beauty as something that we see as superficially attractive. We're looking at something that has a specific purpose, an intricate design, a purpose to fulfill God's glory on earth in what it does and how it fills the role that it was designed for. And even the rattlesnake and the bat and the tarantula, they fill those qualifications for being beautiful. Order in the universe, God is a God of order. Everything he does is precise. There's nothing random about God's work in his dealings with people spiritually, in his dealings with the natural world and what he's created. Everything has an order. And if you look at the natural order of plants and animals and fish, everything fits in its own little niche, and everything fits together, just like the pieces in a puzzle. And the only time that order is driven into chaos is when man sticks his finger into it and decides to change this or that or this or that. And maybe that's a little extreme statement to make, but it's true. God's order is perfect. It's perfect in the natural world. And again, in the design, the intricate specifications that God builds into everything that he has made, plant, animal, whatever it might be. Now, when you are teaching your children in your classrooms about seeing God in the natural world, you have an enemy that is opposing you. You are fighting against a very deeply entrenched mentality in our nation that says, not only did God not make the natural world, but there is no God. That's just a bunch of silliness. And that is a very, very pervading influence in our society today. You will find that if you are looking at the natural world and you are seeing the Creator in his creation, you're in the minority. But you want your students to be in the minority as well. I'm going to read something here, and this came from a publication. It's a scientific publication, supposedly, and it's written by an eminent, well-known scientist. And this is some of the things that this supposedly educated, well-known, eminent scientist has written. "As far as we know, our planet is unique in the solar system. It alone supports life. And more than anything else, this seems to be due to chance. When the cosmic dice were thrown, our planet came out with a double six." This is from an educated man. Another, "As far as we know, no life has evolved on any of the other planets in our solar system. The main reason for this seems to be simple cosmic luck. Planet Earth happened to end up orbiting the sun at just the right distance to support life." Just happened to. Isn't that a coincidence? Again, cosmic luck was on our side. One more here. "The 23-degree tilt on the axis of the Earth, on the axis that the Earth rotates on, was caused by a collision with some unknown celestial body, which fortunately enables the Earth to sustain life." And our society is bombarded with this. It's in the medical world. It's in the educational world. It's everywhere. And it's even, unfortunately, in the spiritual world to some extent, that creation was by chance. And it took zillions of years, and God had a hand in it. But in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. That's where we begin. In 1 Corinthians 3:19-20, "For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, for it is written, He taketh the wise in their own craftiness, and again, the Lord knoweth the thoughts of the wise, that they are vain." Science, the word science actually means knowledge. Evolution is not knowledge, it's a theory. It's a theory that's contradicted by Scripture. The foundation, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. The attitude that earth is our mother is another thing I'd like to deal with here. Just briefly, and this is a portion of a letter that was written in the Olive Branch Ministries newsletter. It was written by a lady named Grace Martin, and she is a teacher at the Cherry Creek Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and that's a tough place to work. She says in her letter here, in the course of a conversation with one of the young men here, I asked him why no one in Cherry Creek is happy. His immediate reply was that it was because of drugs and alcohol. They have lost touch with the Creator, Mother Earth, he said. They need to reconnect with the spirit world. He's so close, but so far off. That's sad. You know, it's sad. Okay, we want to look at God's glory in four. Mark, did it? It might be important. Okay, we want to look at God's glory reflected in four specific areas. Celestial creation, the heavens. Terrestrial creation, the earthlings. Avian creation, that'd be the birds. And plant creation. And that's we're just touching a tiny little bit of it. This is something that should be a six-month course. Celestial creation, the Milky Way galaxy, this is what our front and backyard is. The part of the universe that we live in is contained in the Milky Way galaxy. That includes our solar system with all the planets and the stars. How many stars? Scientists estimate that in the Milky Way galaxy alone, there's 100 billion stars. Kind of a nice round number. 100 billion stars. And of course, that's an estimate because nobody's counted that. And then, of course, we have the eight planets. But they've concluded that for every star in our galaxy, every one of those 100 billion, there's at least one more galaxy as large out there in space. So put all those numbers together, and we don't even have a number that high. But here's the clincher in this one. In Psalm 147, verse 4, it says, He, and it's speaking of God, He telleth the number of stars, He calleth them all by their names. If that's not overwhelming, what is? You know, that's beautiful too. God is a God of order. He not only knows and has manufactured out of nothing all these stars, but He's given them all names. When I talked about that Ed Beecham over there in Sisters, his workmanship is beautiful, but everything he made out of available material. Creation was made out of nothing. Nothing. All those stars, all of us, everything here is made out of nothing. That's creation. It's not manufacturing. Okay, to me, this is, I guess I get almost emotional about some of this stuff because it's so fascinating when you look at what God has done. And when you look at who He is, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth His handiwork. I know if any of you live in an area that is flatland, if you have a dark moon and no clouds, if you have an opportunity to look at the stars, they will run from horizon to horizon. And I've seen this at sea. When I've been at sea on a cloudless night when the moon is dark, it is absolutely overwhelming how much light there is in the sky. And the Bible tells us that in Genesis. It says He gave the moon and the stars for light. But it's where we live now where there's a lot of light refraction. You don't see that so much. But if you get out in parts of eastern Oregon, maybe some of the states you folks come from, you can see that. And it's worth looking at. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is Thy name in all the earth, who has set Thy glory above the heavens. When we speak about beauty, the beauty of the natural world, and you know, whether it's a snow-capped mountain peaks or even some of the animals, a western tanager, a hummingbird, whatever, man is the only creature that God has created that has the ability to recognize and appreciate beauty. There's no other creature on earth that has any comprehension of beauty. That's something that God has put in man alone. And why has He done that? He's done it because he loves us. He wants us to enjoy and to glorify him through what he has created. God is a God of incomparable beauty. I guess maybe the word majesty would even be more fitting, more appropriate to describe our Lord. In perspective, in the heavens, the nearest star, excluding the sun is 93 million miles away. That's fairly close. The nearest star to the Earth is 25 trillion miles away. And to put that in perspective, if we traveled at 25,000 miles an hour, it would take 115,000 years to get to the next star, Proxima Centauri. Sometimes we ask the question to children, what's the fastest you've ever gone? Just kind of, oh, my dad drove, so-and-so. Okay, we won't talk about that. But the fastest we've ever gone, the Earth now spins at 1,000 miles an hour. Well, how come it doesn't just fling us off? We're going 1,000 miles an hour now in a circle. But the Earth is also traveling at 67,000 miles an hour in its orbit. That's really moving. And the Earth, it keeps in the same orbit. It keeps in the same path. It's predictable because God's a God of order. One of the most interesting things that I ran across fairly recently is called Kepler's Third Law of Astronomy. And Kepler was a mathematician who lived in the 15th century, I think it was, 16th century. He was a mathematician, he was a Christian, he was an astronomer, and he was a scholar. And this man, in his observations of the heavens, he said, looking at the planets, he said, there has to be a mathematical formula that describes the action of all the planets. Now that seems like pretty far-fetched to me, but I kept reading. I said, this man spent 12 years. He said, math is an exact science. 2 + 2 is always 4. The square root of 3 of 9 is always 3, and so forth. It's an exact science. And he said, God is a God of order. God does nothing randomly. There has to be a mathematical formula that describes our solar system. And he worked for 12 years, and he came up with a formula. And that formula is this one here. And this is my own designation. This isn't the scientific formula. The T is the time that it takes for the Earth, for example, to make one orbit, a complete orbit, 365 days around the sun. Take that number and square it, 365 and square it. This here is the distance, the average distance of the Earth from the sun over years' course of time. Now, the Earth's orbit is elliptical, it's not oval, so you have to take the average. The average distance from the sun over a given year. Cube that number. Divide the two, and you come up with a number. Come up with a fraction. That fraction is exactly the same for every planet. I thought that was neat. That was really amazing. Now, the period of a planet, or the time that it takes for it to orbit the sun, each planet, it increases rapidly with the radius of that orbit. So the further out they get, the quicker it goes around. That's a mathematical formula, and it works. It holds true. But again, it shows God's a God of order. He's not a random God. He didn't allow things to just go out there with a big bang and everything fell into place. It doesn't make any sense, really, if you think about it. Just think about it. We're going to look at the mammals of the Earth. Mammals, as I said earlier, there's over 5,000 different species of mammals. These are distinct species. They do not interbreed. They reproduce according to their own seed, just like it says in Genesis. And we're going to look at a couple of species anyway. The first one is the polar bear. And the polar bear lives in the Arctic only. It doesn't live anywhere else. It lives in the area of the North Pole, the Northern Arctic. The polar bear gets to be about 1,300 pounds. It's a big animal. It's the world's largest bear. But he is specifically designed, and we look at the design of the polar bear for survival in the environment that he lives in. When you look at it, he lives in an area where nothing grows. There is no plants. There's nothing to eat except the ringed seal, and that is his primary diet. The polar bear is designed, he is white. He's perfectly white. And that's for more than one reason. It's camouflage, so the seals don't detect him, because he just lives in an area that's all ice and snow. But it's more than that. The white coloring reflects sun's rays. His body does not absorb heat from the sun, just to a very, very small extent. And there's a reason for that. The polar bear has two very dense layers of fur. He has a very large layer of fat that insulates him. And even at 50 degrees below zero, the polar bear has to move fairly slowly to keep from overheating at 50 below zero. And this is recorded. This is documented. This isn't just something off of Facebook or whatever you call it. Okay, his feet are 12 inches in diameter for several reasons. Walking on snow and also paddling in the water. He's an excellent swimmer. In 28 degree water back in 2011, there was a radio collared polar bear that was monitored, and he swam for 427 miles over a 9-day period in 28 degree water. Now that takes some insulation. Some have been spotted as much as 64 miles away from any land, any ice mass, any iceberg, or any kind of ice that they can climb up on. There is no land mass in the Arctic. That's in Antarctica. He lives his entire life on the polar ice pack. Except there are some, you can read some exceptions in Hudson Bay. Every now and then they will sneak into Churchill and raid garbage cans. But that's it. And occasionally they will eat an Inuit. But the ring seal is primarily their main diet. And again, it's just that in the detail, there's a lot more detail, but we're going to go on here. In the Antarctic, there's what's called the Weddell seal. The Weddell seal is about as large as the polar bear. And you know, most of you know what seals, sea lions look like. Okay. This Weddell seal can grow up to almost 12 feet in length. They're pretty big seal. Their diet is fish and crustaceans, crabs, mollusks, clams, whatever they can find. This animal can travel for 8 miles under the surface of the ice in 28 degree water for as long as 70 minutes. And remember, in the Antarctic, it's dark for at least 6 months of the year, just dark. So he can't see anything, but he navigates still under the ice pack in the dark for as much as 8 miles, for as much as a little over an hour, and stays submerged. How long can you hold your breath? He also is, this is documented, he's able to dive 2,300 feet for food. And at 2,300 foot depth, I calculated it out, it's over 1,000 pounds per square inch pressure on his body. The maximum that a human being can endure is 58 psi, and he's taking 1,000 pounds. Now, this isn't something that evolved. This is a perfect design by a perfect creator, and it glorifies him. Man can go down to 130-foot depth and survive the pressure. There's a tremendous amount of pressure as you decrease, but he's down 2,000 feet. That's nothing. The sperm whale dives to 7,000 feet and has over 3,000 psi on his entire body. How did he do it? Well, that's the way they were designed. Something else that's extremely interesting. Now, if you're familiar at all with the bends, it's from surfacing from a depth, and divers are very prone to this. It's very, very dangerous. The nitrogen that's in your air system, we breathe in a lot of nitrogen. The nitrogen in the atmosphere is about 72% of the atmosphere. So when we breathe in oxygen, we breathe in nitrogen. When we ascend too quickly from a depth where there's that much pressure, the nitrogen tends to dissipate into our bloodstream, and it causes the bends, and that is fatal unless it's rapidly treated, and the only way it can be treated is be through depressurization. The Weddell seal doesn't get the bends for one reason. He has been designed with a collapsible rib cage. His rib cage, as he descends and the pressure increases, totally collapses, and evacuates all of the air in his respiratory system, all of it. So he can surface right away, it's no problem. He can hold his breath for an hour. This took some designing. And, you know, this was just in, when were the seals made? One day, along with the mammals? It's a mammal. One day. It can also drink seawater, salt water. That's death to virtually almost anything else. There's some seabirds we'll cover a little later that can do the same thing. It has, in the dark, when it's looking for fish or something to eat, it can detect motion in pitch dark through the sensory organs in its whiskers, and it grabs what's moving. It also has a clear membrane over its eyes so that the salt in the sea doesn't affect his eyes in any way. And there's lots more, so we're going to keep going on here. I think what I'm going to do now is go to plants first, and then maybe come back to the birds. Okay, plant life. 60,000 plus different species of trees, and the estimates run from 60,000 to 200,000, and we really don't know how many different, totally different species there are of trees. Grasses. How many kinds of grasses are there? You know, we have grass seed farmers in this area. And, you know, we got bluegrass, and we got orchard grass, and we got ryegrass, and we got fescue, and we got... Well, there's 12,000 different species, distinct species of grass alone. 12,000. See, God's a God of variety. He didn't make just one grass. He can make 12,000 grasses. Sedges, and the sedge, I don't know if you're familiar with the sedge, it's a grass-like form that grows in marshy areas primarily. It requires a lot of water. It has a triangular stem instead of a round stem like grasses have. And there's over 5,500 species of sedge. Rushes are a hollow-stemmed marsh grass. It's not the same as a regular grass, which has a solid stem to it. There's 464 species of those. There's estimated that there's 400,000 vascular plants worldwide, and that excludes the algaes, the mosses, and the lichens. 400,000. And it's a guess. We really don't know. But it's still an impressive guess, because we know that's a lot. Annually, there are approximately 2,000 new species of plants identified and categorized every year. 2,000 new species every year. One of the most interesting things about trees, and all plants, actually, all green plants, contain what are called chloroplasts. And chloroplasts are designed to take the carbon out of the atmosphere. And that's what this up here designates. This is actually the formula for photosynthesis. The chloroplasts in all green plants take the carbon out of the air. And the carbon is primarily in carbon dioxide, which is in the air. And it's about 0.04% of the atmosphere. And takes the hydrogen out of the H2O, which is in the water, which comes through the plant's vascular system up to all the leaves, and that whole thing. That, how does a plant draw water up through a solid mass of wood? But it does. Okay, so the carbon combines with the hydrogen and ends up with this, which is glucose. And it also releases free oxygen into the atmosphere. Glucose is the building material of plants. We had a group of children on a school nature hike, and we come up to a big Douglas fir, I think it was, over in the Coast Range, and I asked the children, where'd all that wood come from? This is a big tree. Where's that wood? Tons and tons of wood in there. Where'd it come from? And they looked a little puzzled, and the one said, well, out of the ground. Well, it didn't come out of the ground, because the ground's flat. It's flat all around there. There'd be a big hole. It comes out of the air and out of the water. And the chloroplasts have to have energy available to make this change, because that's a chemical reaction. And that energy comes from sunlight. The sunlight provides the energy for photosynthesis, which gives free oxygen into the atmosphere, which we breathe and we need to stay alive, and it receives, when we breathe, we release carbon dioxide, which the plants need to survive. Interesting relationship. How'd that evolve? Which came first? You know, this is, to me, I guess it's fascinating. I carried away with it, I guess. So, but when I look at a Douglas fir, when I look at an oak tree, and you see the density of the wood and everything's in it, that come from the air and a little bit of water. Man couldn't devise a system like that, no matter how he tried. That's just, okay. In addition to that, a portion of the energy that is used in this process is also stored in that wood and the material that's built into the tree or the plant or whatever it is, and that energy is released as heat when that wood is burned. Also, if it's a smaller plant, say it's a banana tree, okay, part of that energy goes into the fruit of that tree. And when we eat that fruit, when we eat the fruit of anything that has come from plant life, we partake of part of that energy that was delivered by the sun. All of the energy that we have comes from photosynthesis. And, you know, you put all this stuff together and it's mind-boggling. I mean, it's fascinating to me anyway. Design, perfect design. I'm going to go back and look at some birds for a little bit here. 9,000 different species of birds. 9,000 specific species. I think in the United States there's 750 total. But worldwide, 9,000. Now, you know, God could have just made one gray bird that covered everything. But, you know, look at all the color in the birds. You know, we get everything from an ostrich that weighs 300 pounds to the bee hummingbird that weighs like a quarter, an ounce, something like that. And everything in between. Yeah, you get peacocks and macaws and parrots. And I watched two bald eagles this morning. This is kind of a rabbit trail. But there's a dead nutria out on the road. And there's two bald eagles sitting there watching this dead nutria on the road as the cars zoom by. And I could hear them thinking, you know, that would really be a good meal, but I'm not going out there. I'll get clobbered. So I went out there and I picked this nutria up and I took it out and 100 feet from the road and set it out on the plowed field there. And I went back to the house and here those eagles come down. They feasted on that thing. They just feasted on that thing. They never said thanks, but they feasted on it. I felt good. You know, I thought this is a good deal. When they were done, they took off. There wasn't much left, but the buzzards came down and they picked the bones clean. One bird that is fascinating to me is the wandering albatross. The wandering albatross is a pelagic bird. It inhabits the sea. It does not come into land except to breed and nest for a very short period of time. This bird is born on the rocks along the outlying islands of the coast, particularly in the southern hemisphere. But the first 6 years of its life, 5 or 6 years of its life, it never approaches land. It stays completely out from land. And, of course, it feeds on seafood. It feeds on fish and mollusks and shrimp and those kind of things that are in the water. It's monogamous. It can live 60 years, and it only breeds every 2 years. It has an 11-foot wingspan. And it has been documented at soaring, and they don't flap. They soar. They just ride the currents. With 11-foot wingspan, we could all do that. 600 miles it was recorded as soaring and never alighting. They had those on monitors. Never alighted, it just soared for 600 miles. How can it do that? How can it hold its hands up? How long can you hold your hands up like that? Mm-hmm. Design. There's an over-center lock in the wing bones. So when it lifts its wing up, there's a lock and there's no pressure at all. It's just like these tables out here. You flip the leg out and you lock it and slide it over. And so there's no effort whatsoever, and it can soar as long as it wants to. And there's enough currents over the ocean where it lives where it can continue to stay in the air. The shoulder lock. That's a design. God designed that for that particular bird, for that particular lifestyle. and you know, it didn't take zillions of years for a whole group of albatrosses to get together and decide that we need to design our bones a little differently so we can, because we're getting tired holding our. It can soar, and this has been documented. It can soar as much as 67 miles an hour. That's really moving for a bird. It senses barometric pressure somehow, and 24 hours, as much as 24 hours ahead of a storm, it will move out of the area. There's a gray-headed albatross that was documented as having circled Antarctica, that's 13,670 miles, in 46 days, completely circled Antarctica. An average speed soaring almost 300 miles per day. Almost 300 miles a day. That's moving pretty long. Come down a little more local bird, the great horned owl. They're wherever any of you live, they're real common throughout the United States. The great horned owl has excellent night vision. His eyes don't move, but his head does. He can turn his head about 270 degrees, but his eyes can't swivel. And he hunts by sound. And here's an interesting thing about the great horned owl, and also the barn owl, and there's several others too. Their ears are asymmetrical. In other words, our ears are symmetrical. You know, this one's about here, and this one's about the same place on the other side. His aren't. They're offset, and there's a reason for that. It's called triangulation. And when he hears a mouse rustling in the leaves, or even under snow, even under a covered snow, he can hear that. His hearing is so sensitive. And that triangulation, from the time that first sound hits this ear and the next sound hits this ear, he triangulates and he knows exactly where that mouse is. And the difference in that time is it's an unbelievable fraction of a second. And I read it, but I wouldn't repeat it because it doesn't seem possible. But it is. That's what it is. That's design. He lives at night by sound primarily, but his vision is also very good. His wing feathers, we had a barn owl that was trapped in the warehouse up in Independence for a while. He'd come in at night, and the overhead doors, they only open, when they're all the way open, there's still about a 3 foot space, 2.5, 3 foot space to the ceiling, and they stay high. So he was trying to get out, and he'd fly across the warehouse time and time again. It didn't make a sound. He doesn't make any noise when he flies. The tips of the wing feathers are serrated, and it's silent flight design. And the barn owl is a beautiful animal. And finally, this guy figured it out and got out. So he's happily eating mice today, I'm sure. But again, any animal, any plant, any insect even that you look at, amphibian or fish or reptile, you look at them and there's a life history there that is it's fascinating. Every one of them. And some are more fascinating than others. Yeah, right. The owl kills its prey, and it can kill a rabbit or a skunk or small fox, cat. The great horned owl kills by squeezing. Just it crushes the head of its victim. And that way it doesn't have to fight with it. It's just, that's it. Now, here's something you can do. When you go home, take your bathroom scale and try one hand first. Squeeze that thing as tight as you can. See how high you can get that scale to read. And then try it with two hands. See how high you can get to read. The great horned owl, one claw, 400 PSI. You don't want one to perch on your arm. 400 PSI. This is amazing. Oh, okay. Like I say, I get carried away with some of this stuff. The Arctic tern, another bird. He summers at the north in the Arctic, and he winters in the... No, the other way around. No, that's right. He summers in the Arctic, winters in Antarctica. His migration route approaches 24,000 miles every year. That's one bird, and he's not a big bird. 24,000 miles. But he does it. There's a reason for that, and he's equipped to do that by his creator. He follows the food source. The food source he needs is in the Arctic in the summertime, and it's in Antarctic in the summertime, because our winter is summer down there. Just 24,000 miles. The bronze-headed cowbird, there they live in this area. They live virtually throughout the United States, I think. There's a different variety in the eastern states, but the bronze-headed cowbird is parasitic. Are you familiar with it, the bronze-headed cowbird? Okay. He's parasitic in that he doesn't build a nest. She doesn't build a nest. She just watches other birds that build nests, and when they're gone, she lays her egg in their nest. That's not fair, but that's the way she works. And that egg will usually hatch prior to the host eggs. And that bird grows faster than the birds that are in the host nest. And it will kick the others out of the nest as it grows. And there's lots and lots and lots of bronze-headed cowbirds. We had a towhee nest in a fallen tree in our place once, and I was looking at the nest, and I came out one morning to look at the nest. There was four eggs in it, and there was three eggs, and there's one big egg, and I thought, what in the world is that doing in there? And it was a cowbird. It got down in that, it was a fallen oak tree, it got down in there and laid its egg. The common muir, and that's a pelagic bird also. It's found at the Oregon coast. It will nest on the rocks and the cliffs, and sometimes there's only just a 4-inch cliff, but it's safe there, and that's where it will nest. And it doesn't build a nest, it just lays its egg on a rock. Well, how come the egg doesn't fall into the ocean? It's a cone-shaped egg. It's weird. I mean, really, it's a cone-shaped egg. And if it rolls, it's just going to go back in a circle. It's not going to go anywhere. Design. You know, this isn't something that evolved over zillions of years where the muirs got together and said, you know, girls, we've got to lay our eggs a little different. We're just losing too many. You know, this is... But, okay. Acorn woodpecker. We've got acorn woodpeckers in our place, and they're real common around here in the oak groves. And they will drill a hole in a dead limb or a dead trunk of a tree and store acorns in the acorn, each one. There have been trees documented with over 1,000 woodpecker holes, and I think one of them is in our backyard there. And what they will do also is, as the acorn shrinks, as the weather proceeds, they will take it out and they will put it in another hole that's smaller. Make another hole that's smaller. Because if they don't, the scrub jays will take those acorns and they will have them for dinner instead of the acorn woodpecker. Okay, any questions, anything so far? I haven't given you any opportunity. I'm just doing all the yakking here. Anything? Is this boring to you? Does it give you incentive to help your students see God in creation? You know, he's not just in the church bench. He's out there everywhere. And, you know, if we can see that, it makes our life so much more blessed. It really does. You know, photoperiodism, that's another thing. If you're interested in plants, look up photoperiodism. What that is, it's the plant's response to not so much length of day as length of uninterrupted darkness. A lot of people think that trees leaf out and drop their leaves because of the length of day, and that's not true. It's the amount of uninterrupted darkness. For example, why do you have all these flowering geraniums for sale around Christmas time? They normally, naturally, won't flower until the springtime. But if you have them in a dark room and you break that darkness just a few times, that plant will flower. And that's how we have geraniums that flower in December. Bit of trivia. Okay. There's a lot that goes into photoperiodism, and it's also in animals as well. Why does a ermine change the color of its coat from brown to white? Why does the varying hair, or the snowshoe rabbit, change the color of its coat from brown to white? For camouflage purposes during the winter for survival. Well, that's built into it. He doesn't have anything to say about it. That's the way God made him. And it's a perfect design. Some other things. Oh, I read about, this is interesting, the Arctic woolly bear caterpillar. Never seen one, never known one. But it takes 14 years for it to develop into a moth. 14 years. It's constant. And yet, it's in the Arctic, and every winter it freezes solid. How can that be? It is. It is. The one of the things that always impressed me when we had horses, we would have to scrape their legs from the botfly eggs. And a botfly is one of its stages is parasitic. What it does, it's a fly that lays its eggs on the front legs of horses, and the horses will nuzzle the itch, and it will go into their digestive tract and fasten to the stomach, the larval stage, and develop there, feeding on the stomach lining of the horse, and then eventually work its way out through the body, actually, of the horse, through the wall of the horse. Why does the botfly only lay its larva where horses can reach it? You'll never see them on the back legs. You'll never see them on its back or its hindquarters. Or how does it know that? It's designed to do that. And the insect world is something I'm not real deep into, but it is fascinating. I was just reading this afternoon. There's over 90 different species of mosquitoes. 90 different species of mosquitoes. Okay. The 17-year locust, that thing stays in the ground for 17 years, and then it comes out. How does that work? 17 years. Where are we going to be in 17 years? I know where I'm going to be in 17 years, I think. Okay, I know. The monarch butterfly, it migrates 2,500 miles annually from eastern Canada to Mexico. How can a butterfly migrate? I mean, there's nothing to it. How many moths and butterflies do you think there are? Now, this is specific species. Just moths and butterflies, and they're the same order, Lepidoptera, I think they call it. How many of them are there? You know, a butterfly, and some of the moths, too, are very beautiful. They're very beautiful. There's 155,000 that have been categorized. 155,000. You know, God's got a variety. He didn't make just one butterfly. He made 155,000 different species. You know, and it's for us to enjoy when we look at these things. And butterflies normally are very colorful. The ones I'm familiar with, they're very colorful. And, okay, bird shells. Bird shells are porous. When a bird lays an egg, that shell is enabled to transmit oxygen and carbon dioxide through the shell wall. Design. A perfect creator who has created a perfect design. Oh, there's a lot more. One thing I want to mention before I forget it, if you take your students on nature hikes or field trips or whatever, bring a magnifying glass. Some of the most awesome sights in the natural world are seen with a magnifying glass. Take a magnifying glass and look at the core, the center of any flower. Look at the detail in it. Look at the components of it. It's amazing. Look at the wing of a dragonfly. Look at the... Did you know on a deer? How does a deer stay warm in the wintertime? Deer hairs are cellular. That's a perfect insulator. Air is the perfect insulator. They're not solid hairs. They're cellular. They have air trapped within each air particle. I'm getting awful close. I think 4 o'clock. I think my time is up. I didn't hear the bell, but I think it's up. Any questions? Anything to refute? Or
which bird was it that laid the triangle eggs?
Say again?
Which bird was it that laid the triangular eggs?
The murre, M-U-R-R-E. It's like a cone-shaped egg. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone? Anything? Well, I hope you learned something. I enjoyed studying for it, and good Lord bless you all. And enjoy the rest of your time here.
Thank you.
Even though I think I got information overly pretty quickly.
Yeah. Peterson has a very good forgotten. It's very, very good. It's basic, but it's very good.